Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for April 26th, 2021. I guess we're already to the end of April, which is good and bad because there's so much work to do.
Time marches on.
Time marches on. So we're here in Binghamton. We were going to podcast last Monday from San Antonio, but we couldn't figure out how to do it.
All the stuff that we need to upload it to the server is on my computer at home, which is a desktop, and I couldn't figure out how to get it. Yeah, I don't know all the passwords, and so
it's very hard.
Right. So we've done it. We skipped one podcasts every other week.
I mean, lately we're just our three things that we had, our crappy sound quality, our relentless doing it every week, and our banter are all
but then we dropped number two.
We're just left with the banter and the crappy sound quality. So we popped down to Texas and then came right back up and missed the snow, which was really great.
That was one good thing that was one of the many good things.
About just going there really quickly.
And
we had a really good time, but on the way back we did listen to a book that I found triggering.
I couldn't believe it. It was 11 hours, 8 hours. We had it like on 1.1 speed or 1.2.
No, it was 8 hours, but we went from 1.2 to 1.3 and went finally towards the end. We were listening at 1.4 trying to get through it.
There was only so much that, I mean, I honestly felt like I was at an Episcopal church convention, like a general convention or like a diocesan convention. I don't know if you have ever gone to a diocesan convention in the Episcopal Church in a liberal diocese. You know what this is like. You're sitting there, people are talking from the pulpit or from the podium, and they're saying so many things that are just kind of half true, but it's like this machine gun rate of statements that you to go back and correct the whole thing would be so, and you'd have to just have a recorder stop every
couple of
seconds, say something, stop every couple of seconds, because it's just so much. And so you end up after the 30 minute talk or whatever, it's just feeling just incredibly overwhelmed and discouraged, because
there's like 10 hours worth of stuff that you could talk about. The book took longer because we had to stop every few minutes and note things that were problematical is the word of the year. So the book is called The Making of Biblical Womanhood, and I've now listened to, or I've read, you know, I've tried to stay away from a lot of current books. I didn't read any Kate Bowler, for instance, because I have had to read Jen Hatmaker and other people that it's not fun.
Rachel Hollis. Who's Kate Bowler?
She's a PhD. She's done research into the prosperity movement in America. And I think that some of her stuff, from what I see on Twitter, is interesting. But then I'm gathering that some of the conclusions that she draws from her research are problematical. I can't think of another word. And I think that's what as I encounter this movement within the church, I think somebody called it post-complementarian movement within the church, brought under the heading of Jesus and John Wayne, you know, that the patriarchy is really to blame for all the things that are wrong in the church and maybe even the world. And that patriarchy goes necessarily together with racism, and that the way to deal with this is a conclusion of Beth Allison Barr's book was to stop it. Right. She just said, stop it. What's difficult is that, of course, a lot of things have been described that are real. You know, mm-hmm. Read Jesus and John Wayne. Well, I would say don't read it because it's exhausting. But a lot of things are real and true in their as a description of different movements within the church and in the culture. Well, okay, let me say that. Not within the culture. Nothing is being described about the wider culture that evangelical Christianity found itself inside of. That part is left out, so that it's just Christians that are sort of wacko. They're not...
Well, in Dumais, not in Barr.
In Dumais, not in Barr. All the things are described, but then the conclusions that are drawn... Okay, I mean, let me qualify that again. Not all of the things are described. Some of the things are named and described. And then conclusions are drawn from those things that are not good conclusions. And then the implications of the conclusions that are drawn are not thought out. And so it's an interesting thing, but you should, if you're going to read these books, you should just be really have your ears pricked, because so many things are jumbled together. And there are a lot of error. There's a lot of error in the books, both historically, factual, and theological, in the making of biblical womanhood, that you should be very, very wary of the conclusions that she draws.
Right.
Because if you can't properly, as I said, Jesus, and if you cannot properly explain what somebody else says about themselves or what they really believe, other people are very justified in being wary of the conclusions that you draw about what you have seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the thing is, and this is both with Dumais and with Barr, is they call themselves historians, and I'm not doubting their degree.
I mean,
I'm not doubting their academic creds, but what I'm saying is that the work they're doing is from a perspective, and I get that every historical work is from a perspective. You can't have a non-biased analysis of history, but there are certain types of analysis in which the analysis is done from a purposefully jaundiced, they wouldn't say jaundiced, but from a purposely ideological standpoint. So liberation analysis or class analysis or economic analysis of history always has a certain slant, a certain paradigm with which you go into the study. And that shapes every other thing. That shapes everything you write, everything you see. So both Dumais and Barr go into the study of the history of, well, with Dumais, white evangelicalism in America, and Barr, the study of complementarianism, and how it developed, and its alliance with fallen patriarchy, she would say.
Well, she doesn't distinguish between kinds of patriarchy. So right out of the gate, distinguish.
Well, she does. She just doesn't. She says that complementarianism is the fallen patriarchy.
Yeah.
She says that it's not possible to distinguish the two because they're both the same. But she goes into this with a feminist analysis in mind. So we were talking about with the Dumais book, she goes in with with much the same, and I likened it to Marxist class analysis, where we're a Marxist historian looking at, say, the history of the American Revolution is going to see everything through the lens of class struggle. Like, where how is this revolution, working its way toward pure communism, which is, of course, what's going to happen. How are the class differentials really the cause of this fight? It can't be because of the ideological lens of through which a Marxist views history. There has to be some way that oppression and class warfare is really the heart of this. Same kind of thing with feminist analysis. There's always going to be some kind of oppression going on. And with Barr, it's subtle, but it comes out. You see it in several places. The more women are tied to and bound to the husband and family, the worse it is for the woman. And the progress, the liberation is found when a woman is freed from those bonds. And so strangely, for example, this is going to be an illustration of this, women in the Industrial Revolution who were forced to work in sweatshops were
factories.
That was good because they were able to form communities of women, females again, that were not so bound to husband and family. By contrast, post-Reformation women who were, I think she would probably say, forced to sit in family groups in church rather than being allowed to sit separately. Like, so, you know, before the Reformation, in some churches, women sat on one side, men sat on the other. And that was good for her because women were able to form their own autonomous communities outside of the family unit where all the abuse is. But after the Reformation, because of the focus on marriage and family life, women were brought back under a kind of oppression and made to sit with their husbands in church. And that's bad. Right? So you can kind of see the paradigm that she's working with as she's doing her analysis of history, but it's not really.
Whereas you could say, like, so you have those, you can observe that fact that women sat on one side of the church and men sat on the other, which is still the way it is in much of the world. I grew up in church where the women sat on one side and the men sat on the other side. And there's no overlapping of, you know, the women, where there's women's spaces and men's spaces. I guess that's what's hard for me is, because I grew up in a world, I've experienced many different kinds of patriarchy myself. I've experienced egalitarianism. I've drunk from all of these cups.
Right.
And, some of them were tasted nicer than others. But if you think that a culture where the men sit on one side in church and the women sit on the other, and there's men's spaces and women's spaces, and the nuclear family is not the strongest thing, but the sort of wider family network and culture is, you wouldn't have your individual identity formed by your nuclear family. If you think that that's not problematical, or you think that could be even utopic, or that's not as patriarchal as a nuclear family is, you're very, very naive. Like, you should maybe travel to go on a short-term mission trip, because the patriarchy is very strong and it does exist almost everywhere. Even I would say in egalitarian situations, there's still patriarchy. It's just that it manifests itself differently through passive aggressiveness rather than aggressiveness.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't even say that because, I mean, you went through several experiences in an egalitarian, a purposefully explicit, ideologically egalitarian church, in which, you know, one of her arguments is that complementarianism necessarily breeds abusive men.
Yeah.
And having come out of the Episcopal Church,
that's just not true.
That's not true. I mean, there are abusive men
everywhere.
Everywhere.
There are abusive men everywhere in the world.
And that's not the
and the system.
Right.
Isn't what produces the abusive men. The abusive men live in all the systems.
Right.
Whatever kind of system you have, there are abusive men
right
in it. So that's what in the launch party, they both, all through the Barr and Dumé and McKnight were saying, patriarchalism is a social construct. It was invented by human beings. And so human beings can dismantle the patriarchy. They can get rid of the social construct and have something better. They said that explicitly.
Yeah, yeah.
To which I would respond, that is, I'm trying to think of something kind to say. That is so very naive. That is so very, very naive.
Well, it's like the communists saying we can get rid of class and have all things in common.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't understand what human nature is like. And you know, part of it, so here's her argument biblically is that the complementarian claim, and I'm glad she recognizes this is the complementarian claim. The complementarian claim that God established role differences and distinctions in creation before the fall, and set up the idea of headship before the fall. She says that's all wet. I mean,
she says they say that, but she says that's not true.
Right.
That God didn't do that.
God didn't do that. Instead, patriarchy, she says, was created in Genesis 3 after the fall, when God said, "Your desire will be for your husband, and he'll rule over you." That's the beginning of patriarchy. It's always fallen. And
so before the fall, everything was egalitarian.
Right. So she after thinks fall, she's going back to pre-fallen. That's what she thinks, stopping the patriarchy, we go to pre-fall. If, however, she's wrong, and I think, of course, she is. If, however, headship was established before the fall, all the things that she's finding problematical within complementarian circles or within secular patriarchy or the egalitarian patriarchy.
I'm going to coin that.
Right, right.
Egalitarian
patriarchy. Those are all just ways that the original creation has just been ruined by sin, right? And so the answer is not to do away with headship. The answer is to go back, which is kind of a commentarian project, go back and reestablish as the relationships as they should be.
A redeemed patriarchy.
Right, right.
Which then would not allow you to just sort of what's the word where you just throw something away without really thinking about it? Discount all of the servant leadership language of, right, say, the promise keepers, where in the 90s and early 2000s, there was an effort to demilitarize evangelical patriarchy and get men to vacuum. To pick up a vacuum and help their wives instead of just telling them what to do. I think that did come into the church through feminism. It's not necessarily bad,
right,
for men to realize that they are actually servants of all. But that wasn't purely cynical. Like Dumé would say that was just cynical and wretched, but no, I think did come about from men reading their Bibles and thinking, oh, well, maybe we were wrong. Maybe we shouldn't just be super authoritarian, right, and maybe we should help our wives. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I went off topic.
Well, okay. So the thing that, I mean, we could go through all of the exegetical expositional errors that she makes, and they're just, I mean, every time she touches the scriptures, she warps them, twists them in some, yeah, strange way.
Can I just pause there? Oh no, go ahead.
But one thing that I'd like to just point out is how if you get that Genesis 1 and 2 wrong, you're going to miss so much in scripture. Because Paul in Ephesians 5 goes back to Genesis 1 and 2 as the model for marriage, right? When he quotes Genesis 2:24 and talks about how he quotes that section where God brings the woman to the man, and the man leaves his mother and father and cleaves to his wife, and Paul says this is about the church. He's grounding his understanding of marriage relationships in God's institution of marriage in the beginning. And it's in that section where Paul says, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. And Rykens says the marriage relationship is a picture of Christ and his church. And whatever you say about that word submit, and she makes a lot of assertions about the word submit in Ephesians 5, that it's really a text about how both partners submit to one another, not one having headship over the other. But since Paul is making an appeal to Christ in his relationship with the church, and that's how the church submits to Christ, is how the wife submits to the husband, you cannot work an egalitarian system out of that, because the church and Jesus are not in an egalitarian relationship. The church always submits to Jesus as Lord. He sacrifices himself. He submits himself to death for her. But there's always, there's a hierarchy there, and you can't escape that. And she really doesn't deal with that. She deals with the word submit, but she doesn't really deal with the analogy that Paul's making when he illustrates what that submission is supposed to be like by referring to Christ in the church. She skips over that.
She also skips over the question of why people would think that the patriarchy was established pre-fall, and that's the Jesus. She talks about how marriage isn't really mentioned in the Old Testament, and that it's brought it, that it was put there by Bible translators after the Reformation, and they read it into the text because of their changing views of marriage. Whereas,
right, so she says the language shifts after Genesis 2 and God brings them together, then it's described as a marriage, and
yeah, but then the word's
that's not
really
in the Hebrew,
right? Whereas the reason that theologians and scholars think that God established marriage before the fall and the patriarchy before the fall was because Jesus
in Matthew 19
says that was marriage, what God did there. That was marriage. And so that's another big hermeneutical issue, is that if you don't think that Jesus has the power to interpret the scriptures or is the author of scripture, then you will not be able to read the text in a coherent way.
Right. So she says that the idea of marriage is kind of imposed, or our understanding of marriage is kind of imposed into the text. But when the Pharisees ask Jesus about divorce, he takes them right back to that pre-fall union that God creates and sets that up as the first marriage. Points to it as the first marriage and the model for all their marriages. So even though, regardless of whether the word is used and how it's used in the Hebrew, Jesus gives us the authoritative interpretation of that text. If you don't think that Jesus gives us the authoritative interpretation of the text, then you have a Christological problem, which she does.
Yeah,
she because that's not the crystal. First place where she thinks Jesus is mistaken.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a minute, but she thinks Jesus is wrong in his earthly ministry about something very important.
We'll go ahead and say what it is.
I think I was going to build in suspense into it.
Oh, okay. All right. Keep going with your suspense.
So anyway, we're kind of shotgunning this. This is what happens when you listen to a book like this. There's so many things you want to point out as being full of error, but there's so many things we're shotgunning, we're machine gunning ourselves.
It's a really very violent and patriarchalist image that you've used there.
Yeah. So maybe we should start by saying how the book kind of starts out, which is her narrative.
No, because I don't want to actually, I have to write a review for this, and I don't really want to go systematically through the book. I guess we could.
I don't want to go systematically through the book, can we talk about how she frames everything?
Yeah.
So she frames everything through her personal experience of what I think she would call it oppression in complementarian circles. She was.
So, she went to a church. She was her husband was working in a church where women were not allowed to teach at all. Not they could teach children Sunday school, but they could not teach boys over the age of 12 because that was the age of spiritual something or other when you become a man, I guess. Mm-hmm. And she and her husband asked the church to reconsider their stance on women, and they were very quickly fired when they asked for that. And it was very painful. And so that set her off on this trajectory that she had already been on, because as a professor of religious medieval studies and women at Baylor, she had already been thinking a lot about this stuff. So she was really appalled, and you can see in the book, very frustrated by not being allowed to teach when that's her profession. So, you know, that sets it up. So first of all, right out of the gate, the thing that I kept wanting, because she uses that example over and over through the book, she mm-hmm. comes back to it a lot.
I'm a qualified teacher, but I couldn't in this church teach 13-year-old boys about the Bible.
Yeah.
Because I'm a woman.
Yeah. So my first thought was go to a different church. Like, I would never have gone to that kind of church. If your theological sensibilities think that you should be allowed to teach people if you're a woman, then you should go to, there are lots of churches, even complementarian churches, where that is just not an issue.
Right. I think that the church she was going to was confessionally bound to a certain brand of complementarianism. And that brand of complementarianism is not the only brand of complementarianism by far, but it was bound to a certain branch of complementarianism, which women can't teach men in any context. And so that's part of their confessional statement. You might think that's, so let's say you're going to that church and you come, like she did, to the conclusion that's wrong, biblically wrong. What do you do?
I mean, I would suggest that you go to the church and say, I've confessionally come to disagree with the confessional statement of this church, and so I'm so sorry, but I'm going to have to go away from this church, and I love you so much, and I hope to see you in heaven, but we can't worship here anymore. Thank you so much.
And there's nothing wrong with that. That's
it's if it's become a dividing issue for you, then that's tragic, but that's one of the things that happens.
You have to decide. I mean, can I in good conscience continue to go here? And there's every church you're going to have things you disagree with. I mean, you're not going to find a church from which 100% everything was right down the line, what you believe in. But the question is this such an issue that I can't in good conscience maintain my fellowship with these people?
And I would say, like, because it is a secondary issue, I would say that it's a secondary issue, whether or not women can teach boys the age of 13 for me is a secondary issue. So I might be inclined, especially if I really loved the people in the church and that was the only point of my disagreement, I wouldn't leave. I'm an Anglican, so I wouldn't go to a Southern Baptist church anyway. So I just don't. But if I was Southern Baptist, I would probably swallow it, because I really do think it's a secondary issue.
So you'd stay, but in staying, you would also have to commit not to try and change the church, right? You'd say, okay, I'm going to stay in this. I'm going to accept that this is what these people believe, and I'm going to submit myself to that. Maybe not teach that myself, but not oppose it.
So one of the things that I think about submission is that the problem with submission is that it isn't about and this is what complementarians have come to believe. It isn't about making other people submit to you and change for you. It is about you getting on their turf, getting on their terms rather than your own. And that is a very, very countercultural thing. I think her ideological bent would require her to go to the church elder board and ask them to change, because that is what is good and godly, not the other way around. And I would say that
you mean like because of the just the nature of progressivism,
right?
That
it cannot submit itself to something it doesn't
it's not progressive.
Yeah.
So it has to change. It's the nature of progressivism, in other words, maybe I'm going too far here, is like that of a parasite. Where when the host, it consumes the host. The host has to.
Oh, right. And we saw it firsthand. Eventually you cannot have people who disagree with you.
Right.
That's just not allowed. So
because when they do, they are standing against freedom and liberty.
Yeah.
And justice. And so they have to be silenced or changed.
Right. So the second thing I thought, just in this first initial.
Can we finish this whole the plan? Okay. Naturally, I'm a pastor of a church, and if someone on my staff were to come to me and say, I think that Anglicanism is, I think liturgy, let's say liturgy, I think liturgy is wrong. I think that saying said prayers, wrote prayers, is an affront to God, and I think we should change that. I would have to say, okay, well, that's essential to what we're doing here at the church. It's not essential to your faith. You might go to heaven because you don't like. I mean, you will go to heaven if you don't. Whether or not you love liturgy has nothing to do with your eternal salvation. I think you're wrong, but because that's the kind of church we are. If you can't live with liturgy, you're going to have to go. You can't be on the staff here because you have to be supportive of the way we are. If you try to change us from within, we can't have that in the on staff. So I would have to say the same thing. And I guess complementarianism is a higher level theological disagreement. But even on a lower level, you'd have to say, okay, well, we're going in a different direction. I can't pay you to undermine the direction of this church. So it makes perfect sense that, I mean, I'm sure it was very painful, but it makes perfect sense that her husband, having changed his mind and also in a position of teaching children, youth group, would be asked to leave.
That's not oppressive.
Right. It's not oppressive. And then the church was very honoring to them. It sounds like they set up, they gave them 3 months and then severance package
and a send off
and a nice send off in which their portrait was there. And there was a box for people to put nice messages in. And she saw that as a big lie. Like she saw that as an angry act covering over the real thing where they were mean to them and fired them. I think that sounds like the church is trying to honor you.
And not shame you, not humiliate you.
Not say now you've
destroyed everything. And
right, I mean, the church could have been very public about it. We think these people are now in error theologically, and so we're we're firing them, and we're firing her husband, and we're no longer letting them come.
Which is what would happen if you committed adultery. If he was the youth minister and he had an affair, he wouldn't be there the next morning. And then that would be very shaming. But right. When it's something like this, you may feel shame, but that doesn't mean that you have been shamed.
Right.
By everyone.
But that experience is now then becomes the kind of icon for how complementarianism abuses its people within it, women within it, and subjugates women within
it. So, but then the big, big problem as you go through the book is that she has so many exegetical and theological errors that I, who run a Sunday school, including there's 12-year-old boys, and I've written a lot of curriculum for children and youth, and I've worked on that for a long time. I, speaking as a woman, if Beth Allison Barr came in and tried to teach any of the things that she says in this book to my Sunday school children, I would fire her based on her exegetical
ability.
And if you walked into my Sunday school and said that the Syrophoenician woman taught Jesus anything, you would be out of there so fast. and I wouldn't put up a nice box where people could write things to you. And so maybe the staff, maybe the church fired them too quickly, but maybe also they saw that there were big theological and exegetical problems going on, and that, and so maybe they made it a question of gender. A woman can't speak to the young children or the boys. I wouldn't have done it that way. I would have done it based on how well you can work your way through the scripture, and still you have a big problem. In other words, Beth Allison Barr is not qualified to teach children in my Sunday school.
Yeah, I mean, so she mentioned, this is the thing I was hinting at earlier. It's only one line in the third chapter where she's talking about, I think it's page 75 in the Kindle version, where she's talking about the women and how exalted a status they had in Middle Ages. And she's kind of idealizes. She does mention there, she does, of course, say there were problems then, but she idealizes the role of women in the church in the Middle Ages, while at the same time acknowledging that to have the prominence they had, they had to be like men. Yeah. She says the key aspects of their femininity, their sex, sexual activity with their husbands, they couldn't be married. The more they were like men, the more prominence they had. The monastic movement, in that sense, enabled them to be seen as kind of these, as people who could teach, because they were less and less like women. But she thinks that's better than, she seems to think that's better than complementarianism. And women had this kind of prominent role in the church in the Middle Ages. But in that section, she mentions offhandedly that a woman won an argument with Jesus. And then in the parentheses, she points to Matthew chapter 15. So she's talking about the Canaanite woman in Matthew, who's also called the Syrophoenician woman in Mark. Canaanite's just the reference to the region. Syrophoenician is what Mark uses, and that's a reference to her ethnicity. And so she makes the assertion that Jesus was wrong, that he, maybe a man of his times, had imbibed the ethnic prejudice of the first century Jew toward Gentiles. And that's why when the woman follows after him, asking him to help her because her daughter is demon possessed, he treats her in the typical fashion of the first century Jew. And he says, well, you know, I can't take the food for the children and give it to the dogs, and referring to the Gentiles. And she says, even the dogs eat the crumbs off the children's table. And then he says, for that answer, your daughter will be healed. And to say that the woman won that argument is to say that, one, there was an argument, and two, that Jesus was essentially racist, and he was corrected by this woman. And that has all kinds of implications for your Christology. Mm-hmm. If you think Jesus was a racist, that he uncritically accepted the prejudices of his society, then you have a sinner
on your hands. A racist sinner.
Right. You don't have the God-man who is inherently sinless and who always speaks the truth. You don't have the man who in John says, every word that I say comes from the Father. You have instead a fallen, flawed man who is capable of sin. And if you have that, you don't have a sin bearer.
Right. You don't have the atonement.
Right.
Like you are going to die in your sins.
Right.
Somebody I know pointed out, this new reading of that text, it's popping up everywhere. I think is really horrible, but somebody said it's gaining popularity because of the growing anti-Semitism on the left, because not only is Jesus racist, I mean, it's a posture of being, he's Jewish, which is also unacceptable. So it's not just saying that Jesus was a man, it's saying that he was a Jewish man and therefore not to be countenanced. And that so there's so many problems with looking at the text that way, that I thought was interesting. So
right. Well, I mean, it explains why that explains why she just dismisses Jesus. She doesn't deal with it. Jesus' discussion of marriage in Matthew 19, because it doesn't matter. It's wrong. It also, you know, it plays into her critique of inerrancy, like the idea that inerrancy is the doctrine that says the Bible doesn't err in what it reveals. There's no error in the scriptures of history, of any kind of error at all. And she characterizes the doctrine of inerrancy as a means by which the patriarchy silenced women. This is where the liberation lens through which she studies history comes to the fore, because she cannot allow for a sincere faith commitment on the part of those who developed the doctrine. I mean, I would argue that inerrancy, even though it wasn't articulated this way, is something you find all the way back through the 2,000 years of church history. Ask a patriarch if the Bible errs, and they're going to say no.
The church believed that the scriptures were true and had power.
Right.
So, an authority.
Right. So it's not like a 20th century, 19th century doctrine that it just popped up because of the patriarchy. It's something that has always, no one believed the Bible was an error throughout church history. It's just that in the 20th century, it was articulated in a careful way. She, however, doesn't seem to understand the doctrine. I mean, she likens it to literalism. She over and over again, she conflates the doctrine of inerrancy with kind of a shallow wooden literalism, the kind of thing you might see when someone says, what is this? Which psalm says that God
part of the sea from with his nostrils,
blast from his nostrils, and says, oh, well, God must have a big nose. That's how she just conflates it. She doesn't see. So, for example, in her mind, an inerrantist must believe in a literal 6-day, 24-hour day creation. Whereas, I mean, I think it's fine. I have no problem with that understanding of Genesis. But that's not necessarily inherent in inerrancy. You can be an inerrantist and have an old earth understanding of creation. I don't think you could be a theistic evolutionist, but you can have at least an old earth creationist perspective. You can be an inerrantist and even argue about the genre of certain books, whether they're historical or whether they're not.
What's not inerrant is our reading of the Bible. You know, we have to keep struggling because we err,
right?
But the scripture doesn't err. And so that's a interesting sort of twist, because Barr is clearly thinking that her
right
read on everything is not an error, but
we listened to the audiobook, but I'd like to go back and see if she has footnotes in the inerrancy section to the Chicago statement, because the Chicago statement just kind of blows up all of her straw manning of the doctrine. It specifically deals with the question of a literal reading and says, look, we read the Bible literally. We take the genre in which the author is working, and we interpret it in light of that genre. So, you know, the contrast between, say, a proverb and a narrative book is vast. Proverbial statements are not necessarily true in every single instance. So you can look at proverbs and see these are general truths, whereas you're reading a narrative, we would want to say that everything that is recorded in that historical book is happened just the way it's recorded, because it's an inerrant text. So you use genre to help you understand how to interpret a text, but that's all lost in her characterization of the doctrine. It's just the doctrine is just there to support complementarianism or support the patriarchy. using a quote unquote, and she uses this phrase, a literal reading of Paul.
Yeah.
And then you say, what? Paul is writing letters. Right. So if Paul says something like, wives, submit to your husbands, is there a metaphorical reason reading of that? Is there a mystical reading of that? Was there an analogical reading of that? What do you mean a literal reading? There's a direct didactic command that we need. We definitely want to think about how that plays out, how it works, how to interpret it. But of course you take those words as they're intended, which would be straightforward. The historical grammatical sense of the words, which is, wives submit to your husbands. I don't think that's, Paul goes on to make an analogy between, Christ and his church, but that also helps us understand the words, doesn't it? The wives submit to your husbands as to the Lord. So it's just a strange, it really belied a pretty deep ignorance of what inerrancy is, how, its development, it's the understanding of the truthfulness of the scriptures that you can trace from the beginning. You can see it in Jesus, who says to the Pharisees, the scriptures cannot be broken, and who appeals to the scriptures as the final arbiter of truth over and over and over again. But if you don't believe that Jesus is right,
then you can't. Yeah. Well, I would just like to say, this is going on a long time, a couple of things. One, I do feel increasingly at odds with mainstream evangelicalism, I guess, because mainstream evangelicalism has taken a sharp left turn mm-hmm. away from me. And for those who have listened to this podcast for years, you'll know that I never really enjoyed the word complementarian. I can say that I agree with the Danvers statement. While saying that, I don't like the way that certain communities have lived that out. Like I've said over and over again, the words on the page can all be in the right order, but then when you look at some Christian communities, the way they look, you can see that something is terribly wrong.
Right.
And I've said that.
There's some truth to what she's saying.
So the purity culture, as we've said, there's big problems with that. You can say all the right words of the Bible, but then the way that you think that you're living them can be really terrible. But the thing is that that's true for everyone. That is true on the left and on the right. The problem for me with the left is that you've stopped saying the words. They've stopped saying the words in the right order. They're right. Just not even saying the words. And so I haven't moved on any point theologically in a very long time. As the world shifts around me, I'm sure people think that I've become radical and right-leaning, and they will think that when I review this book. But having lived in a very progressive world where the scriptures are not understood and not taught and not valued, I can tell you that that is a cold, howling wilderness, and that Christians should be very careful of walking down that path and just embracing what Barr does in this book, because the egalitarian patriarchy is not any nicer than the Vision Forum.
Yeah.
And actually, in the evangelical world, the sort of people who even call themselves complementarian, like the people who wrote the Danvers statement, those men are Christian people and they love the scriptures, and you may not like the way that it looks for them, but they demonizing them, like demonizing John Piper or an Al Mohler, Russell Moore.
Yeah, Russell Moore comes in for some criticism.
He's like, that's, you should pause there.
I certainly agree with you. I mean, you know, we've talked about the way that in some realms, complementarianism becomes inhuman, like that people stop relating to one another as individuals and start relating to one another in accordance with their roles, and they lose something there. Whereas I think that the notion of male headship doesn't have to require that. And so there's some, you know, pretty strong disagreements that we have with some interpretations or understandings of headship in the complementarian world. And you know, we would agree in some cases with, you know, with what Amy Bird was saying, not all of them, but what Amy Bird was saying in her some of her critiques of the movement.
I would just say, yeah, don't lump Amy Bird's book together with this one, because Amy's exegesis, while I don't know if I, again, would have agreed with everything, she's so much more careful in the scripture. She actually deals with some of these texts, and
she puts headship back at Genesis 1 and 2.
Yeah.
So
I've seen like a clustering of these books together, and they're not all the same. Not everyone is like, and you don't have to agree with Amy either. You don't have to come to the conclusions that she comes to. I think, you know, raising the questions is fine as long as you're prepared to answer them. So
two more things about this book
before. Yeah, then we should really
The first thing has to do is just the, and I want to go back and look at all the citation she uses, but she does use people like Rachel Held Evans and Sarah Bessie and of course Dumais as models
source
of
source material.
Yeah, models, source material. You know, she's people who have clearly gone off the rails with regard to sexuality are used as
perfectly
sympathetic,
fine.
Perfectly fine, sympathetic voices.
Yeah.
So just be careful about that. Secondly, the translation, her translation section, which I thought was one of the more egregious sections of the book, and that's saying something. The idea in, you know, a word for word translation of the text of a biblical text is you're trying to get to, you're not doing any interpretive, you're trying to do as little interpretive work as you possibly can. You're trying to get the words on the page in English as they are or appear in Greek, if you're doing the New Testament. So she was elevating the TNIV, the New International Version, which is a gender sensitive translation, in which if the text in Greek uses the word adelphoi for brothers, but it means a whole church full of people, which would include women, then the TNIV will translate that brothers and sisters. And when it's interesting, throughout her section on interpretation, she does not mention that Greek, like English, earlier English, the Greek has that convention shot through it. Greek is one of those languages that uses the male pronoun.
It's like French.
Like French, to refer to mixed groups of people. So if you have a group of women, you'll have described in feminine words. But if you had one man to that group, it suddenly reverts to the masculine. And so an English translator is going to use that same convention if he's trying to be faithful to the original text. She considers that, she thinks of it as a kind of a patriarchal plot. So when she's talking about English, she kind of sets English up as a unique language that does this. That English, as the Bible is translated into English in the early the King James Version and other
Geneva Bible,
that there was this kind of plot to take out women. So when the example she uses is the Vulgate's translation of Genesis 1:27, which in Latin, it translates Adam, you know, in the beginning, God made man, in the 6th day God made man, male and female, he made them, whatever. The word for man is Adama, and it does refer to basically human. And in Latin, it was translated homo. The English translations, however, use man, and she sees that as some kind of
conspiracy theory.
But at the time, that's how you referred to humanity. You referred to humanity as man. That's just the kind of language we have. It wasn't a plot. It was humankind wasn't used. It was just, it was just the way you did it. And in fact, if the translators of various versions are going off the Greek and Hebrew together, which you do when you're translating the Old Testament, you use the Septuagint and the Masoretic text, then they could have, I don't know what the decisions were, but if you weight the Greek text as more accurate, which is, there's good reasons for doing that sometimes, then you might have the word, then the Greek would also use the male pronoun to refer to human. That's just how language works, and translating it accurately is what you do when you're trying to provide an accurate picture of the original language. But she presents all of this in kind of the cynical way in which the translators and the English language itself is guilty of oppressing women. It's fascinating.
But she goes back and forth between Latin and, you know, she uses the Latin, the Vulgate, when it suits her, and then she'll, in the same sentence, flip over and use the Greek.
Right.
So she's very,
dishonest in that section, yeah. I think. She's dishonest. Academically dishonest. That section lacked a lot of integrity. The fact that she doesn't even mention that Greek has the very same convention that English does with the use of the masculine pronouns, when that's a huge part of the debate between the TNIV and the ESV and the other versions, is inexcusable. I don't see how you do that as a scholar.
Well,
but I'm not a scholar, so maybe if I were a scholar, I would learn how to do that.
You'd learn how to do that. So, well, we've been going for an hour, and so because there was so much in this book, and because I was so disappointed at the end when she said somebody asked her to paint a positive vision for how women should be in the church, and what she said was stop it. She did that funny Bob Newhart thing, just stop it. I really have, this has been on my mind for a number of years. That I do want to, because she and others are experiencing, and I am also, a really deep shift in the culture. The ground has shifted under our feet, and we are not living in the 1950s. I hear that.
Yeah.
I've said that quietly to myself for a lot of years. You know, women have all gone to college and they've all taken women's studies. And when they go home, like John MacArthur said to Beth Moore, they're really unhappy because they don't know how to be there. They've never been, it's not been a place where they have any comfort or happiness. And on top of that, there are now so many jobs that men and women can both do. There is not a differentiation in work for men and women anymore. Everybody can do thought work. So what would it look? So, and I, you know, what you need to do is a missionary work. When you encounter a new culture, you bring the scripture to that culture and you read it and you let the culture be exposed to the light of scripture, and then the culture shifts and changes. And that tumultuous work has to be done. And I am going to try to do it myself because nobody's doing it for me. And
I'm going to save the culture.
I'm going to save everybody. No, I'm not going to do that. No, I mean, I.
No, I hear you.
I would. I've long thought, like, for instance, we're sending our daughters to college. If they want to go, I'm not going to force them because we're not mean like that. But we're giving them an education. We've taught them to read. We expect that they'll marry men who know how to handle a vacuum. And
wash dishes.
And that doesn't mean that we want to overthrow the patriarchy. So it's a complicated time to be alive. And I think that there could be a sort of exciting time in the church, but not if you just are completely dismissive of the scriptures.
Yeah.
So
it's the only last thing.
Okay. Sure.
We listened to the launch party and it was interesting to listen to Dume and Scott McKnight. I'm pretty sure they're interacting with your piece.
I know. I felt
like with your review of like Dume's book.
They were talking about me.
Scott McKnight said that some of the reviews were disgusting to him.
And I'm pretty sure it was just the one because I didn't see any others that would have been upsetting to anyone.
Scott McKnight is a deacon in the ACNA, and he's one of the canon theologians of the Diocese of the Sake of Others, and he's on the launch team of
this book,
which posits a Jesus who is wrong. So I would say that to me is disgusting. I think he should rethink that, and he should repent of that and get off this launch team. And the same thing is, you know, he's kind of fawning in this. I guess you have to be fawning if you're doing a launch teamwork, but he was fawning over the book. And interestingly, while they were clearly talking about your review, saying you didn't understand that she was just writing history, they wouldn't name you. And I think the reason they wouldn't name you is because they didn't want to call attention to the review, because it was very good. It was very pointed. It was pointed, but it was accurate and good. And you undid a lot of the, you expose a lot of the fault lines, the places where Dume was being dishonest in places and simply strawmanning her opponents. So, and that was not what they expected for coming from a woman, which is probably another reason why they didn't name you.
Well, I think that the CBMW having me write this review was like the ultimate troll. I feel like it was pretty epic troll of everybody in the world. And I was really happy to do it. Super happy to do it. And Denny Burke is so fun. He's just a fun guy. It was fun to work with him. And I was really grateful that they asked me to do it because I was so grossed out by Jesus and John Wayne. I wanted to put words to the paper. So, but now we've gone on for an hour.
This is one of the longest podcasts we've ever done.
Yeah, it's really terrible. And so we have to go and
listen to it at 1.4 speed.
Yeah, you'll get through it in 20 minutes. Pro tip. So thank you so much for listening. And maybe we'll be back next week.